You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous, gorgeous place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time tonight. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and I think you will be too. It's always fun, and this is Monday, so it's the beginning of a brand new week, and we are off the porch and running with the big dogs. Interesting things happening, you know, around the world, and we're going to, tonight is open line night, so that means that we're going to throw the telephone lines open for you to talk about whatever you want to talk about except politics. All right, very quickly, if you're brand new, you don't know, but you need to know, we have a free weekly newsletter. It is called the K-Files E-Zine, and the K-Files E-Zine is very simple to subscribe to. Just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, kevinsmithshow.com. When you get over there, you'll see a little button that says K-Files E-Zine. Click it and subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Very quickly, a couple of announcements that I know a lot of you regulars are interested in. You know that we had to move the studio because of the lightning strike and affiliated and associated problems that came up as a result of that. Okay, well, that's very time-consuming, and yes, you can be up and running and do a show pretty quickly, but to get things all leveled back out and balanced out and sounding good takes some time, and we've had to do a lot of that. So you need to know that those of you who are subscribing members, you need to know that the K-Pods are up to date. Yes, you will see that there are some dates missing. Pardon me. But if you will remember, that was during the time when we had to do replays, rebroadcasts, because of the move and the reassembling the studio and so forth. So if it's a rebroadcast, it's already there. It's already in the K-Pods. There's no reason to put it in again. So, but they're all up to date. And then some of you have written to me wanting to know, when are you going to start giving the free podcasts again? You know, the one every week. Well, you do have to understand that when it gets to be crunch time, we have to take care of the things that people are subscribing to and paying for. The free stuff has to wait. However, everything seems to be pretty much back in order. And so this week we will begin uploading a free podcast each week. And we'll do that starting this week. So all of that is back up and running, and that's a good thing. Hey, the Large Hadron Collider, you know, that everybody was afraid of, it broke. And I guess most of you know about that. It's going to be down for at least 2 months. Are you aware of the fact that the way that it broke caused tons of liquid helium to leak into the collider's 27-kilometer tunnel? If you can't control tons of liquid helium, Why should we have confidence that you can control a possible black hole? Pretty good question. I got that one in an email, and I thought I would pass it along to you. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it's Open Line Live. We'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. It may be a question that you have for me. It may be a question or a comment about a guest or a topic that we've had, or just something from out of the blue. We'll be back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. It is Open Line Live. That means, of course, that we are going to take your telephone calls. It means that we are going to let you talk about what you want to talk about, so long as it's not politics. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Hi, hello. Kevin. This is Polly.
I'm sorry? Polly. This is who?
This is Polly.
Polly?
Polly.
And where are you calling from?
I'm from Virginia.
Okay. Polly from Virginia. Are you a first-time caller?
Well, I'm a first-time caller, but I talked to you last week with my son from Fuquay.
Ah, now I know who you are.
Have you talked to Joe Resnick yet?
No, I have not.
Oh, too bad.
What's up?
You need to ask him about the blue man.
Okay.
You know, I talked to him, and I told him that I had called into your show. I talked with you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, thank you, sis. That just verifies a story. And I said, well, have you told Kevin about the blue man yet? And he said, no, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope he calls you and lets you know.
Yeah, if I don't hear from him, I'll give him a call, and I'll try to get him to tell me the story of the blue man.
It's very interesting.
Very good.
And listen, you look better without that wig on, okay?
Do you know the story behind that?
No.
The story behind that, I was getting a whole bunch of email from some people who were really upset with my book, and I was being invited to go to hell a whole bunch, and so I had these shots made that where we could put the flames in there, and with a black background and put the flames in, and my wife at the time suggested, you'll look even more distressed if you put this wig on. And so I put the wig on. So that's what the deal was.
Okay. Yeah. I forgive you for that.
I've got another one that I never put up. And
why not?
Oh, well, it's really, really.
I
look really either tormented or excessively angry, one or the other.
Well, whatever. Listen, Kevin, I want to tell you about another sighting I had.
Tell me about it.
I only told you about one that I had. This was a long, long time ago. We were, me and my husband at the time, were traveling to California. And we were on a highway that was going, I think, to nowhere. But I believe we were, like, in New Mexico. And I sighted this object in the sky, which looked like a V, with lights all around it. Well, of course, he thought I was nuts, and I wanted to follow it, but he would not. But I think it was way back when, a UFO. I don't know.
How large was this?
It was very large. It was very large and very visible.
It was daytime?
Excuse me?
Was it at nighttime?
Yes, it was night.
Mm-hmm.
But we were close to Alamogordo, and I didn't know at the time, but I did find out recently that they did do testing there up there, whatever
yeah.
it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, how you said this was a long time ago? About what?
Oh my, yes.
What year do you think?
Like 40 years ago.
Wow.
Yes.
And the reason I responded that way is because generally we haven't heard many reports about these V-shaped craft until the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, so that puts it back, you know, another 20 years or so.
Right.
Cool.
Well, this Polly, wedding I told you about, I was just like 3 years old, and like I said, I'm 65 now. That was a long time ago, and I've never heard anybody say that they've seen an object like I've seen.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for the call. It's always exciting to hear about people's sightings, when what they saw. And by the way, did this thing make any noise?
Well, actually, we were in a car that was closed up, and no, it did not.
Now, did it fly directly overhead, or was it at some distance?
Actually, it was kind of like stationary in the sky. Of course, we were moving, so.
Okay. Wow. Well, look, thanks for the call, and I will, I'll check on the Blue Man story.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin.
All right.
Have
Bye-bye.
A great evening.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, folks, the telephone number is 623-237-3814. Let's get that up on the screen for you. 623-237-3814. Now, and by the way, the line is open and available to you. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you remember a few nights ago when I just mentioned in passing that the astronomers now are saying that maybe they've been looking for signs of life out in our solar system, out in our universe, maybe they've been looking in the wrong place. And I just sort of in passing mentioned it. Well, I got a little more information on that. And the deal is that they've done some computer models about the movements of stars in our galaxy. And they've pretty much determined that our sun is sort of a galactic hitchhiker. It's the theory used to be, and probably still is for many astronomers, that a star doesn't wander too far from its birthplace. Where it's born is just sort of about where it's going to be. It's going to stay in its neighborhood. Well, what they've discovered is that's not the case. And our star, the sun, has wandered quite a distance. Older stars, of course, have had more time to wander and have gone further from their birthplaces. And so whenever they start looking for what they call a habitable zone out there in the galaxy, it has to be in context of where a star started from. And so now, you know, we're faced with this information that perhaps our star came from someplace far, far away. Now, the reason I find that kind of interesting, do you remember a couple of months ago I had Dr. Brooks Agnew on the show with me? And do you remember we were talking about his theory that it's beyond a theory for him. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here when I say that I think he believes strongly that our solar system is, and especially our planet, is formed by the fusion of a couple of planets that were slightly out of phase with each other, and one of them, at least, was wandering around. Okay, well, now here is some information from astronomers saying, you know what, at least part of that might be verifiable. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and where are you calling from?
Kevin, this is Joe from Pittsburgh. How are you tonight?
Well, hello, Joe from Pittsburgh. Tell me about the Blue Man.
Yes. My sister just phoned me a few minutes ago. I didn't have the opportunity to check into the show tonight. But But this was something that happened to me when I was a young man, a little boy, actually. And, you know, without recanting everything that my sister, I'm sure she's told you, I can just verify that that happened to me. I put together...
Well, she didn't actually tell us the story. She just said, be sure you ask Joe about the blue man.
Okay, I was... in my recall, I was about 5 years old at this time, and I had been playing in this old car that belonged to my father, and my sister had put her cats in this car, and I went out to look at the cats, and as I was playing with the cats went limp, but my mother had told me to watch out for thunderstorms, and if I saw lightning, to come back into the house. Well, I saw a flash of light, and as I was playing with these cats, the cats went limp.
You mean they went limp as if they were dead?
Yeah, they went limp, and I thought that I had done something to the kittens. So I began to cry. I'm like 5 years old, right? So I can remember crying, and I had been wearing the shirt that my grandparents had sent me. They were in... Boot heel in Arizona, and it sent me a cowboy outfit. And I had this cowboy outfit on. I wasn't wearing the hat, but I had this howdy doody shirt on, a pair of pants, chaps, and these red cowboy boots with yellow stars on them. Never forget it. But I was crying, and I set the cat down. I remember wiping my nose with my right hand, and I reached up, and this was a 47 Ford Coupe, and I reached up on the front seat. And as I reached on the front seat, I looked over my left shoulder, and there was this little blue man turned around smiling at me. And then he said, and I had been singing this song called Go Tell Aunt Rhody.
Yeah, I remember that song. The old gray goose is dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So as I turn and look at this thing, and I'm wiping the spittle from my nose, this little blue man says to me, and in this type of monotone, go tell Aunt Rhody. And he touched my hand, and that's the last thing I remember. I disappeared for 3 days. I was missing for 3 days. And there are newspaper articles about this, you know, fawn boy missing. You know, state police searching for this little boy. So I show up 3 days later under a tree down on the back end of the property. And... you know, the police were here. I can remember Dr. Heinemann being here examining me. And what they found was that I had a hole in the base of my septum, my nose. I had blood, dried blood on my face. And the doctor asked me, he said, did you fall on a stick or a pencil or something? And I said, no. So here's, it turns out, years later, I had some scans done on my brain. I have a hole at the base of my septum, inside where my brain is. Now, I don't know if there's an implant there or anything. No one ever told me about that. But that's the story of the blue man. And I've documented it, and I haven't published the stories yet because of a lot of different reasons. But essentially, that's the story of the blue man.
Do you have any memory of what happened during those 3 days?
I do not. I have no recall at all, no memory of anything. I just remember that little blue man touching me on the hand and his face, and he had extreme brow ridges and teeth like a horse. And I've drawn sketches of it. I'll shoot them over. I'll shoot you a copy.
Yeah, do that. It doesn't sound like he appeared like the grays that we've seen sketched.
I've never seen anything like it. I've never heard of anybody talking about blue people.
Yeah.
This was looked like a little blue man.
Wow.
With a square face. Yeah, it's pretty freaky.
When you say little, how little?
I want dwarfish.
Uh huh.
It was a small man. It looked like a small man. That's what it looked like to me.
But with extreme brow ridges.
Here's the coup de grace to this story. My sister probably attests to this. some weeks later, my father had these champion, these champion blue tick beagles that he used to use to hunt, and he got them from this friend of his down in Georgia. They were very expensive animals at that time. That was in the 50s, you know,
mm-hmm.
or the early 60s. And I can recall my father having paid some astronomical amount then, maybe $200 for one of these blue tick beagles. But one day I painted the dog blue, and my father saw, you know, me doing this, and he went ballistic on me. He said, "What the heck are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm painted this dog blue for the blue man." He said, "Blue man?" Then I got the tar whooped out of me, and I never talked about it again.
Well, I guess not. That would demotivate anyone.
that would motivate a 5-year-old little boy.
Yeah.
But that's the story of the blue man. Yeah, I'll shoot it to you. But to say it was an abduction, an alien, I can't say that.
Uh-huh.
You know, but...
Well, it's certainly bizarre.
One of the weird things that have happened to me in my life. There have been a lot of them.
Yeah, you have shared some of those with me and some with the audience here.
Yeah, I have, as a matter of fact. All right, Kevin, I'll leave you with that. Keep up the good work, huh?
All right, thank you much.
Over and out.
All right, folks, that's Dr. Joe Resnick. He's been a guest on this show and shall be again, I hope. Now, this is Open Line Live. That means, of course, that we will talk about whatever is on your mind, as long as it's not politics. And, I enjoy Open Line Live. I hope you do, because it gives us the opportunity to hear from each other. It gives us the opportunity to, we get to hear from people who are just like us. We get to hear from people that, you know, they're not ufologists. They're not experts on alien abduction. They're just folks like us. And we get to hear from each other what is going on and what has gone on in our lives relative to the types of things we talk about here on the show, and I find it to be fascinating. Now, I was talking about this thing with the sun, that our sun has been wandering around the galaxy, and the neighborhood that we now find ourselves in is not the neighborhood where our solar system began. Many astronomers say that our moon is not part of this solar system. Many astronomers have said that our moon is actually from somewhere else, and nobody really knows how it got here. It may be that it's not from somewhere else, that it was here when our sun came dragging us along and picked it up. I mean, that's a possibility. I received, and I'll have to look into this some more, I received today an email from one of our listeners that had a photograph attached to it, and the photo was from one of our satellites that studies the sun. And I don't know the name of the satellite, but it's capable of peering through that blazing covering of flame that is all around the sun, and can actually peer down to the surface of the sun. I didn't know the sun had a surface. I guess I never really thought about it. But it does, and it's kind of a cracked-up honeycomb configuration. The interesting thing is the north pole of the sun is collapsed, or it appears to be in that photograph. So I'll look into that some more and see what we find out with that. Do you remember, now we're coming up on a break, but do you remember the shows that I did several years ago on Lake Vostok? Those of you who have been around for a while, you remember, right? Well, we've got some more information. All right, we're back. It's the Kevin Smith Show, and I'm Kevin Smith, your host. And it's open line live tonight. Now, I mentioned Lake Vostok. Lake Vostok is a lake in Antarctica. And let me see if I can show you where it is. That is Antarctica. The red circle that's on your screen is Lake Vostok. That's the location of it. All right, now, there is, of course, an American base in Antarctica. And that American base in Antarctica is right there. All right, so it's on the map, it looks close. On the ground, it's not close at all. All right. It's hundreds of miles away. Now, the reason that that lake is called Lake Vostok is because there is a Russian research base there by the name of Vostok, and it's right on the lake. The lake is a warm water liquid lake. It is very large, and it's under 2 miles of ice. Now, I want you to think about that because those conditions are very similar to what the astronomers think and the scientists think are the conditions on Europa, one of the moons of Saturn. Europa is covered with ice, but they think that there is a liquid warm water ocean under that ice. And the reason they think that is because of the fracturing on the surface. Now, Antarctica has not always been covered in ice. We know that from a lot of information, a lot of reasons we know that. One of the reasons we know that is because there are very, very ancient maps that show Antarctica without ice. And when satellites, radar satellites, did radar imaging of Antarctica to see where its real coastline is, you know, through the ice, it matched those ancient maps. We also know it because in Antarctica, or on Antarctica, which is a very large continent, scientists have found the remains of dinosaurs. They found the remains of woolly mammoths. They found the remains of trees. And so they know that there was a time in the past when Antarctica had a more tropical sort of climate, a more tropical environment. So here is this lake, warm water, liquid water lake, under 2 miles or so of ice. And when the scientists found it, this was really, really, really something that excited the science community, and they did MRI imaging of the lake, and what they found was that this lake is, it has two parts. There, in the across the center of this lake, there is a shelf. That shelf sort of runs right along the center of the lake. And so you have deep water at one end of the lake, and then it rises towards the shelf, and then you have it falls off into deep water at the other end of the lake. Now, they've been able to determine that from MRI. They've been able to determine that from radar imaging and so forth. But one of the things that they haven't done, or we didn't think they had done, is they had not drilled all the way through the ice. They drilled almost through the ice, but not entirely. They had not drilled all the way through the ice into that bubble of a thin layer, and I don't mean density. I just mean there's not a great deal of height there before you hit the surface of the water. And so they hadn't actually drilled into that atmosphere. Now, I'm holding a report out of Russia. This report is from Pravda, and it is, in fact, several years old. This report is from 2003. Now, I told you back at the time when I did those shows on Lake Vostok, I told you that they were going to try and drill through and recover whatever signs of life they could from that very prehistoric water. And in 1999, according to this, in 1999, they did that. A research expedition discovered a virus in Antarctica, and neither people nor animals had immunity to the virus. So I did a little research on this. I kept doing some reading on this, and I found a really bizarre theory. Now, that theory, there are several theories about where this virus came from. You got to understand that. It's way down. It's 2 miles under ice. How did it survive? Well, how did it get there is another question. One of the questions that needs to be answered is, where did it come from? Some people think that it rode in on a meteor. Maybe. We just don't know for sure. Some people think that it's just a prehistoric virus that, it's very, very ancient and it somehow has survived. And then others think that it may be part of, now this is bizarre, and I want to know, I'm going to open the phone lines back up now in just a moment. I want to know what you think about this. There is a theory that it may be part of a Nazi biological weapons program. And those who think that have some pretty interesting facts that they call upon to support their theory, facts having to do with the fact that the Nazis staked out a vast area of Antarctica and called it New Schwabenland, and that there was a Grand Admiral, Karl Dönitz, of the Nazi regime, in 1943 said, "Germany's submarine fleet is proud that it created an unassailable fortress for the Führer on the other end of the world." And, of course, there have been lots and lots and lots of rumors about a Nazi base in Antarctica. At the end of the war, there were specialists for the Third Reich that wrote at the end of World War II that as the war was coming to a close, the submarines were relieved of their torpedo arms in the port of Kiel, and then were loaded with containers of all kinds, various types of goods. The submarines also received passengers whose faces were hidden behind surgical masks, so they didn't know who they were. And there's some more. What do you think about that? Do you think, first of all, that the Nazis successfully built a base in Antarctica, a secret base? Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz said they did. What do you think? Let's open up the telephone lines and start taking your calls again. We don't have to talk about Lake Vostok. We don't have to talk about the possibility of a successful Nazi base there. But we do want to talk about whatever is on your mind. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name? The caller has left the line. Elvis has has left the building. The telephone number, if you wish to call in, and I hope you do, is area code 623-237-3814. If you live outside of the United States or Canada, you're outside of that area, you can send a flash message, and you do that. Look, some of you have sent me email during the week and said, I sent you a flash message, but you didn't read it. Well, if you sent it to the old address, which was flash@kevinsmithshow.com, that's gone. I announced it would be gone because of the spam mail we were getting, and it's gone. In order to send me a flash message, go to my website. It is kevinsmithshow.com, and when you get there, scroll down till you see the link that says flash message, and click that. That's how you send me a flash message. That's how you'll be sure I get it, all right? Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Douglas from upstate New York. How are you?
Doing great, Douglas. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. I just had a quick question. I'm wondering if you had heard or read any updates about the proposed journey that was supposed to be up in the Arctic area in regards to the Hollow Earth theory. I remember reading something that, and I don't remember, it could have been last summer, but I think it was just this past summer that a group was going up to do further research and investigation. I hadn't heard anything since I originally read this story, which again may be a year old, so I apologize. But do you know anything about that? Anything in addition to what little I just said?
The only thing I know, the team leader for that expedition is Dr. Brooks Agnew, and he has been a guest on the show several times. And each time that he's with us, I ask for an update. And the last time he was with us, which was several months ago, he said that they are putting together the final piece of their financing for this mission, and it's a very expensive mission because they have to charter an atomic-powered icebreaker. Yeah. And
they didn't go yet this past summer, then?
No, they haven't gone yet. I know they haven't gone yet, but I think they are nearing the completion of gathering all of the funding that they need for that. And it's still on. It's been a long haul to put it together. You know, the original team leader died suddenly with a heart attack, I believe. I believe it was a heart attack. And so everybody thought that, okay, well, that's it. It's over. And then they asked Dr. Agnew to become the team leader. And he was willing to do so, but he required some restructuring of how it was going to be done, and they have done that. And so I think they're nearing the ability to go ahead and do it.
Okay, understood. And then quickly, I'll just ask you another quick addendum here. With the fact that the UN meetings are going on in New York this week, did you hear anything in regards to any more of those meetings that were conducted back in, I believe, February or so? Any of those things that Dr. Sala reported on, or any of those meetings that had taken place originally, were those? Have you heard anything about anything projected for this round of meetings, or nothing?
No.
Has come to light as of yet?
No, I have heard absolutely nothing about any possible further meetings.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Thanks for the call, man. All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen. It is time for a break. When we come back from this break, we will continue with Open Line Live with your questions, your comments, and I'd like to know what you think about that whole Nazi base thing. It's been around for a long time. It's not new. What do you think? Is it real? We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host, and it's Open Line Live tonight. You know, this story about the Nazis, This story has been around for a long, long time. And, you know, there are a lot of people in our world today who want to revise history. And they don't want us to look here. They want us to look there. But facts of history, if we can uncover them, often show us that there's something else we should be looking at. Some of the interesting facts about this story, and I'm not saying this is true. I want you to understand that. I'm questioning whether it is. Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz in 1943 said, and I'm quoting, "Germany's submarine fleet is proud that it created an unassailable fortress for the Führer on the other end of the world," end quote. Now, in 1945, April the 13th, 1945, a German U-boat, U-530, left the port of Kiel, K-I-E-L, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but it left the port of Kiel. And it reached the shores of Antarctica. 16 members from the crew built an ice cave and put boxes into the cave. It was allegedly said that the boxes contained relics of the Third Reich, including Hitler's documents and some of his personal belongings. This operation was codenamed Valkyrie 2. And when it was over on July the 10th, 1945, this submarine, the U-530, entered the Argentinian port of Mar del Plata and surrendered to the authorities. Now, the fact that it did enter the port, the fact that it then surrendered to the authorities, is well documented. There are pictures of it that were in the newspapers of the time. It was a mystery, but there it was. There are two other submarines that were supposed to have been part of this operation. The U-977 was one of them, and the U-465 was one of them. And the U-977, it is alleged, and this is rumor, this part is just rumor, but it supposedly carried the remains of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, along with some more of his documents and personal belongings and so forth, and stored them in this cave. There's not a whole lot of information about what role the U-465 played. But there is a very interesting letter that surfaced. It was written in 1983. It was a confidential letter from Captain Scheffler to his friend, Captain Wilhelm Bernhard. And apparently, Bernhard was going to be publishing a book that told the story. And Scheffler was urging him not to publish this book. And he said, "Isn't it better," and I'm quoting from the letter, "isn't it better, please think again, isn't it better to picture everything as a fable? What results do you plan to achieve with your revelations? Think about it, please." And so it's been conjectured that maybe Wilhelm Bernhard was in fact going to reveal the secrets of this Nazi base. We do know for sure that they staked out a very large area of Antarctica. And you know the way they did it? They flew over the area, and every 25 kilometers, they dropped a projectile that, like a spear, that had a Nazi flag on it. and they mapped out, they staked out their area, and it was a very, very large area. I don't know. I don't know. Admiral Byrd was in charge of Operation High Jump. Now, this was definitely after the war, and we had, as president in the United States at the time, Dwight David Eisenhower, formerly most famous for being the Allied general, the five-star general, war hero, and much beloved. Once he was president, he put on Operation High Jump. It is the largest naval undertaking ever in the history of the United States of America. They went to Antarctica, supposedly as a research team, but they had all kinds of fighting men and weapons and materials. And Admiral Byrd went there. He was in charge of Operation High Jump. It was supposed to last for about 6 months. It lasted for 6 weeks. And Admiral Byrd said, after the operation was called to a halt, that if we ever have to fight another war, it will be against forces, I think is the word that he used, that can fly from pole to pole at incredible speeds. He never talked about it again. It's a great mystery, a tremendous mystery. That gets thrown into the mix in this story about a Nazi base. And, of course, you know, there's also this gigantic, gigantic ice crawler that was built especially for that mission. You know, when they took it through the streets to put it on the ship, they had to take down the traffic signals and lights and light poles and stop signs and things on the corner just to get it down the street so they could load it on the ship. Now, that thing was a self-contained machine. It was supposed to be able to, it had tracks, and it was supposed to be able to crawl out on the ice and go wherever it needed to go. And then it was supposed to be able, also it had living quarters. It had, you know, it had a self-contained restroom and a kitchen and sleeping quarters and everything for a crew, I think, of 16. So it was big. And it didn't make it back. It disappeared down there somewhere. So it's a big, big mystery, this thing. And I'd like to know if, now put your thinking cap on, because I know a lot of you have been involved with all of this type of information. You've heard it, you've studied it. You've been involved with it for years and years and years, because this rumor's been, I guess, since World War II, this rumor about a Nazi base on Antarctica has been around. This is not new information. Now, I will tell you the one thing that is new to me, I did not know that Grand Admiral Dönitz had said in 1943 that the submarine fleet had, in fact, built an unassailable fortress for the Fuhrer on the other end of the world. I didn't know he had said that. So that's new information for me. But the rest of this I have run across before, and you have too. I really would like to know what you think about this information. I really would like to know if you think that it is plausible that a Nazi base was successfully built there, and if so, Do you think that it has been successfully operated for all these years and is still in operation? That's what I'd like to know. I'd like to know. Look, I know that it's speculation on everyone's part. I know that. But I'd like to know what you think about it and why you think that. The telephone number is 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814. We've got some other interesting things beginning to happen. Now, don't forget about that. I want to know what you think about that. But we're going, after this break, we're going to get into this new space race a little bit and something curious that I've been seeing. Maybe you've noticed it too. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. It is Open Line Live, and that means that you can call in with any question, any comment. Maybe there is a topic that's on your mind that you want us to think about, you want us to talk about. Maybe you have had a strange experience of some type. Well, this is the time, this is the place. And the telephone number is 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814. And we'd be more than happy to hear from you. Now, I have mentioned all of this about Lake Vostok and about the possibility that there is a functioning Nazi base there, or that perhaps there was, and that it may be the origin of this virus that was found in 1999. Before we get into the space race topic, think about this. What are the odds of drilling an ice core and finding a little microscopic virus 2 miles down? What are the odds of that? Well, if this virus is sort of an isolated case, there aren't too many of these things, the odds of that would be astronomical. But I'm persuaded the reason they found it is because this virus proliferates there. How would you be able to just drill a hole 2 miles down and be lucky enough that you found the one or two remaining prehistoric viri that are down there? The odds of that are just astronomical. That means that probably, at least in my way of thinking, probably that virus proliferates. There's a lot of it down there. I'm not sure that it's smart to bring it up and put it in a laboratory and revive it and see what happens. I don't think that's real smart. However, it's been done. And, it might be dangerous. Now, you might say, it's not a dangerous bacteria. It's not a dangerous virus. But here's the deal. If it is indeed prehistoric, we have no immunity to it. In the early part of the 20th century, European and American explorers that went up into Alaska and into the far north reaches of Canada exposed the Native Americans there, exposed the natives, the Eskimos, to the cold virus, the common cold, and wiped out vast numbers of these people with a common cold. Then there was the flu, and they wiped out massive numbers with a common flu virus. You get the flu, and most of us, even without any type of medication, because there's not really any medication you can take for it, but even without medication, you just drink lots of fluids and get plenty of rest, and you're over it in a few days. But that's because we have a built-in immunity to it. We're not completely immune to it, but it just doesn't hit us that hard. But when it hit the Eskimos, when it hit the Native Americans up there, it decimated them. There were thousands of them dying. Well, this little virus or bacteria or whatever it is that they found down in Vostok, I would submit, if it truly is prehistoric or if it rode in here on a meteor, has the capability of doing that to the world. Now, the reason I say that is because if it's been down there for millions of years, as they say it has, some people don't buy that. Some people think that it hasn't been down there for millions of years but arrived with the Nazis. Don't know. But if it's been down there for millions of years, we don't have any immunity to it. A report of the U.S. National Science Foundation says, and I quote, "Antarctica's subglacial lake has the same basic boundary conditions as the ocean under the ice on Europa," end quote. And I won't read all of this, but Igor Zhotikov, a corresponding member of the Russian Academy of Sciences, member of the International Commission for Antarctica Researchers, says, quote, "It is not ruled out that there are more lakes under the ice shell of Europa. Even the subglacial sea and the Lake Vostok are direct analogs of that existing on Europa. It may contain microbes unknown to scientists." And so the report goes on and talks about the possibility that by opening, exposing those viri to our current environment, we may, in fact, unleash something on this planet in this time that we can't handle. Don't know what you think about that. I would if you called, but you're not calling, so I don't know. I shall ramble forward. I've talked with you in the past, several times over the past couple of years about this new space race. And I've said that I think that there is indeed a new space race on. China is really advancing rapidly, and I think are to be congratulated from a scientific point of view on their very rapid growth in the whole field of space travel. And they are going to send within a week, as early as Thursday this week, they're going to send the Shenzhou 7 rocket into space. It'll be the Shenzhou 7 mission, and it'll be the first to carry a full complement of 3 astronauts. So it's roughly equivalent to the old Apollo program that America did, and they're going to actually do an EVA, which is an extra vehicular activity or a spacewalk. So they're actually going to do a spacewalk. It'll be about a 40-minute spacewalk, and the lead astronaut, and pardon me if I mispronounce this, but it's Zhai Jingjiang, I believe, is the name, and I'm sure I mispronounced it. I apologize for that, but that's as close as I can get. But this lead astronaut is going to carry out the 40-minute spacewalk. They are taking incremental steps, but doing so rather rapidly, wouldn't you say? They went from not having a space program to doing a spacewalk in a matter of, what, a couple of years? Now, China says they are going to the moon. That is where they plan to go. Now, they have no official missions planned to the moon yet, but there have been some comments, some statements by some of the people involved in their space program that they do intend to go to the moon, they do intend to set up a colony there, and they do intend to mine the moon for H3. Now, Chinese scientists have made those statements. They plan an unmanned moon landing in 2012. And they plan a mission to return samples from the moon in 2015 and possibly a manned lunar mission by 2017. That's 3 years ahead of the goal that the U.S. has set for returning to the moon. So the U.S. is planning on getting back to the moon by around 2020. And China says, well, we're going to be there by 2017. I've been noticing something. I've been noticing on NASA TV and today on Yahoo, there's video, not video, but there's pictures of this. The astronauts now, driving around down at the Cape in sort of the back trails in a tracked personnel carrier. Have you seen that? It's a very military-looking personnel carrier. It's the M113 personnel carrier. What are astronauts doing training to drive a personnel carrier? A tracked, armored personnel carrier. What's up with that? You may have seen it. It's yellow. It's a bright yellow color. And the astronauts are shown driving through sort of the back country in this personnel carrier. Now, some of you may have the answer to that. One can imagine, and I've got all kinds of possibilities that it could be, maybe they just don't have enough to do. These are the astronauts that are training to go do the Hubble repair mission. But they're driving around down at the Cape in this armored personnel carrier. Or I'm saying armored, it's steel. It's a personnel carrier. Got tracks on it. Some of you have seen that on NASA TV. Some of you saw it in news reports and possibly on Yahoo today. You can check it out on Yahoo. It's there. Pictures of them, all in the backcountry there in the Cape area. So one possibility is that these astronauts really just don't have anything to do, and so they're going for joy rides in this personnel carrier. I don't buy that. Astronaut training is very highly programmed each and every day. They've got lots and lots and lots of things they have to accomplish. I would suspect that that's part of their training. I would suspect that's part of the program. But then the question is, why? What's that for? Astronauts, you know, whatever they do, when they actually do what they're being trained to do, it's not on this planet. They fly away from this planet and go do the things they've been trained to do. I've already said that I think it's not conceivable to me that this would just be extracurricular activity out for a joyride, all of them out there, get their pictures taken, in this M113. Now, that might be the case. It might be they just had a free day, and they all suited up in their flight suits. I don't mean the pressurized suits, you know, but the NASA jumpsuits. They all suited up in those and went out and got in this personnel carrier and said, let's go for a joyride. Could be. But I don't think so. What's the use of a tracked vehicle like that? Well, it goes. It's able to go over some really rough terrain. It's able to climb some pretty steep inclines. It's able to do things that a wheeled vehicle cannot do in terrain that a wheeled vehicle cannot perform in. That sounds a little bit like the moon, doesn't it? I mean, that sounds to me like there's some sort of training going on for that vehicle or something very similar to be used on the moon. Now, one of the possibilities is that they are training to be able to drive military vehicles on the moon. Well, I don't think that's the case. And I don't think that's the case quite simply because the moon is big enough that even if we had, you know, if the Chinese are there and if the Japanese put a base there and if we put a base there and the Russians put a base there, it's spread out. It's not populated. As far as we know, the moon is not populated. So it's spread out enough. I don't think we would, like, need military vehicles there. But you see, a tracked vehicle could also, not only could it be used for transportation around, you know, kind of a spread out colony, but tracked vehicles could be used for mining. Do we have any plans to mine the moon? I don't know. I have no idea. We've had guests on this show that have said that from their point of view, from their perspective, from what they say they know, I've had guests that have said that we have a base on the moon already. And people ask me a lot, Kevin, I get these emails. Kevin, what do you think? Do you think that's true? Do you think we actually have a base on the moon? And my answer to that is I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't seen enough evidence for me to make up my mind as to whether we have a base on the moon. Are we going to have a base on the moon? Well, there's plenty of evidence for that. There's plenty of evidence for it because we have a the president has said we're going back to the moon. We're going to establish a permanent human presence there. And that's enough for me. I mean, you know, if the president says that's what we're going to do, NASA generally will follow the president on that. And we have people at NASA that are working on it. So, yeah, you know, there's plenty of evidence that we're going to have a colony there. But do we have? I don't know. But it would seem to me that the stories that we've heard about mining the moon, you know, that is, we've heard from different folks that is one of the key reasons why there's a new space race on. And if that's the case, well, are we seeing the beginnings? Are we seeing the early stages of learning to manipulate the vehicles that will be used on the moon for that to happen? What is it that we would mine the moon for? Well, the only thing that I've heard anybody talk about is H3. You know, let's say that there were gold deposits on the moon. There may be, I don't know. But the cost of transportation, I mean, the cost to get over there to mine it, and then you have to mine it, and you have those costs, and then the transportation of that gold back to Earth, those costs would drive you completely out of business. No one on Earth could afford those costs. Governments might could afford them for a little while, but you would have to have a really, really important reason for why you need gold for you to pay those kinds of prices to bring that gold back. But H3 is apparently abundant on the moon. Apparently it's just all in the soil, and you just dig up the soil and basically sift it. And I don't know what process you have to put it through, but they say they can do it right there on the moon. And they say that if you could pack just the amount that you could get into the shuttle cargo bay would be enough to power the United States for a year. Imagine powering the entire United States for 1 year on one cargo load of that stuff. That would be phenomenal. But you see, in order for us to be able to do that, you gotta have a process where you can use H3 for fuel, and they call it cold fusion. No one has really been able to perfect a cold fusion process that's economically viable, as far as we know. But it appears to me, and I may be just reading something into these astronauts driving that vehicle. It appears to me, though, that maybe we're getting ready to be able to drive the machines that will be used for that mining process on the moon. Maybe that's what's going on. Something's going on. I mean, look, unless they were just out for a joyride, and I don't think so, because, I saw it on NASA TV, and then today I'm on Yahoo looking at the news, and I see it on Yahoo. So apparently it's not just a joyride. Apparently it must be part of the training. And the question is, why? Why do astronauts need to be able to drive a tracked vehicle? You know what I'm talking about with tracks? Like a tank, it's got tracks instead of wheels. Why do astronauts need to be able to do that? I mean, they need to be able to fly rockets. They need to be able to navigate in space. They need to be able to do a host of scientific things, but why do they need to be able to drive a tracked vehicle? Where would an astronaut need or even encounter the possibility of driving a tracked vehicle? The only place, you're not going to drive one at the space station. It's not big enough. So the only place where you would be driving a tracked vehicle would be on the moon. Or Mars, if, you know, we ever get over to Mars. But then the question is why? Where? It's going to be the moon or Mars. Why? Well, just transportation, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you know, here in America, for those of you who think that we did go to the moon, we in the Apollo program, you know, they took these moon buggies up there with them, and they drove them around on the surface of the moon. We got videos of it, right? And so, you know, why would you not take moon buggies again? Well, maybe we're going to be in a more rougher terrain than where we landed before. That doesn't seem feasible or plausible because of the fact that you still have to land a spacecraft, and it cannot have a lot of boulders and craters, and so you got to land it on a pretty level place. So that being the case, it's not just transportation. It's got to be for some kind of work. We'll be back right after this.
You can't do anything. You ought to know by now. Who else must cigarette?
Welcome back. It's the Kevin Smith Show, and tonight is the formerly open line show. The phones are now closed for the remainder of the show. I did receive an email that I was reading just now, and it says it was informing me that that yellow tracked vehicle has been a fixture at the Cape since the 1960s, and that, in fact, it is an escape vehicle if something goes wrong during the launch. Yes, I know it's been there for a long time. Have you ever seen astronauts out driving it around? I never have. And maybe that's all it is. Maybe it's just training for escape. But think of this. You're sitting up in the cockpit of the shuttle. Something goes wrong. You're not going to be able to get down to that vehicle to escape. Okay, so it's an escape vehicle for other NASA workers, maybe. Okay, I can buy that. Then why are the astronauts training to drive it? See the questions? That's the deal. Those are the questions. Kevin, why did you close the telephone? Because you weren't using it. All right. So we've got this space race going, and we are the Chinese are much into the space race. The Japanese are much into it. We have heard that the Indians plan to be in the space race. We have heard the Iranians plan to be in the space race. It is truly a new world in which we live. I don't understand, and I'll pose the question one more time. Yeah, that is true. It is an escape vehicle, or so they say, the yellow personnel carrier, the tracked vehicle. If you're in the space shuttle, you won't get to it to escape. If you are other personnel and you're using it to escape, okay, fine. So why are the astronauts riding around in it and learning to drive it? Don't understand that. But I'm sure there is a reasonable, logical answer for it. It would seem to me, though, that it would make sense for that to be driver's education, if you will, for whatever type of vehicles are going to be used on the moon. All right, we've got a little bit of time left in this evening's monologue, and I want to get to the what UK experts are saying about Stonehenge now. You know, Stonehenge is a mysterious place, and there's been all kinds of theories about who built it, how did they build it, how did they move those great stones from miles and miles and miles away to where they are. How did they set them up? How did they put the capstones across the top? I'm sure that's not what they're called. They're not called capstones. But, you know, you have the stone pillars, and then there were stones around the top of it. How did they do that? Well, nobody really knows. As the archaeologists continue to study Stonehenge, they find new things about it. And, of course, we know that Stonehenge is astronomically placed. And we know that there are astronomical features and a precise astronomical alignment of Stonehenge. But one of the things that they have found, first of all, it's been 40 years since there's been any real, intense, organized archaeological work done around Stonehenge. There have been little things here and there, but this is the first excavation of Stonehenge in more than 40 years, and they've uncovered evidence that the stone circle, for whatever other purposes it had, attracted people that were ailing from very serious diseases. And what they've discovered, they found some graves, and in these graves what they've discovered is the evidence of some of these ailments. And they've also discovered that on those stone pillars, there were chips off the stones, apparently used as magical amulets for people who were really, really sick, ailing from a variety of diseases. And according to Darville, the chief archaeologist there, his name is Timothy Darville, one of the archaeologists, he says, people were in a state of distress, if I can put it politely as that, when they came to the Stonehenge monument. So for whatever other purposes Stonehenge may have existed, apparently a lot of the people around viewed it as having, viewed that place as having some magical ability to cure these very serious ailments that they had. They found a couple of skulls that indicated that even a primitive form of brain surgery was performed. Now, in Egypt and in South America, in the Mayan and Aztec and Inca areas, skulls have also been found indicating that there was brain surgery. And the interesting thing about that, in those two locations, both in Egypt and in South America, they discovered that it was apparently successful, at least physically successful, because, you know, they would drill a hole in the skull by some means unknown, and that had begun to heal over. The bone had begun to repair itself, and and the hole was too big for it to ever have grown completely back together, but the bone showed signs of healing. So we know that the patient survived. They didn't die in surgery. They survived and lived at least some time at length after the surgery. Well, it doesn't say anything about that in this case. The article that I am looking at says nothing about that in this case. But apparently the people who were coming to Stonehenge were coming there maybe for the astronomical reasons. Some of them were coming there for that. Some of them were coming there for whatever religious rites may have been performed there. But a lot of them were attracted by the fact that they thought it had some magical ability to heal them. Now, that would indicate that there was extant in their time some stories that indicated that people had been healed there. And we'll deal with that when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And when we went away for break, I was talking with you about the UK archaeologists at Stonehenge and what they had discovered. And apparently, from their discoveries, they have determined that a lot of people were coming to Stonehenge back when it was in service, when it was working. A lot of people were coming there because they thought it had some sort of ability to heal these very debilitating and even fatal diseases. Why would they think that? Well, there had to have been someone somewhere that had a visibly debilitating disease or condition that visited Stonehenge, and something happened. They went away from there well instead of dying. Now, you might say, well, that's a big leap. Well, no, people don't just make up things. I mean, a miracle takes place, apparent miracle takes place, and the person that is really, really in bad condition goes away well. Then the stories begin. That's the way that happens. What they make up is that the place itself had some sort of miraculous power, or the priest had some miraculous power. That sort of thing gets made up. But it gets started by a real event. In the middle of every myth or bit of folklore, there's always a kernel of truth. But at Stonehenge, you remember when we had Walter Bosley on talking about the ley lines? Stonehenge is the intersection of some major ley lines. And that brings up, you know, that whole question, that whole possibility of, do the ley lines actually have some sort of, do they emanate some sort of power that can be help for you health-wise? There are stories that these ley lines can make you ill, but what about the possibility that they can possibly heal? I don't know. This whole ley line thing is a real mystery, even now. There are people who can find these ley lines. I've watched it on television. In fact, I watched it in a documentary about Stonehenge. And I saw a dowser, you know, that holding dowsing rods, who located a ley line at Stonehenge, and I think maybe two ley lines, but one for sure, with the dowsing rods. And this apparently is well known. Apparently, for centuries, this ley line knowledge has been there, maybe for millennia. In recent times, it seems to have been discovered again that there are ley lines there at Stonehenge. Well, okay, if they are there, and assuming that they are there, and I have no reason to think they're not. I watched the guy find one with his dowsing rods. They also used an electronic meter and measured the difference in the radiated energy in that where that ley line was. So there it is. But what is it? What are ley lines? And apparently they must have some healthful benefits, because the people were coming to Stonehenge thinking that they would receive the help health-wise that they needed. So there had to have been some that did. Was the ley line involved? And did the people actually receive that help? Well, that's the end of the monologue. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be back next time with a guest. And maybe I'll open your phone. We'll see. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.